Hello and welcome back to the Bunker Daily. I'm Andrew Harrison. We hope you're enjoying the podcast. Remember, you can support us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon and get early ad-free versions of the podcast, plus very nice mugs and t-shirts as well. If you like, search Patreon Bunker Podcast or see our social media for more. Today, the economy is terrifying right now. The biggest recession since 1707 is supposedly on the cards. Government is propping up business in ways unseen outside of wartime, and we are bracing ourselves for unemployment that could make the early 1980s look like a mild blip. How are we going to get out of this? How can we pay off the massive debts incurred by lockdown? And what are the industries and sectors that might give us a very different working economy in future, and which are the ones that seem doomed? To help me with all of this, I'm joined by economist Dr. Gary Young, co-deputy director of the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, NISA to you and me. He rejoined NISA in 2017 after 17 years working on monetary policy and financial stability at the Bank of England. Hello, Gary. Thanks for joining us in the bunker. How are you?
Very good. Thanks, Andrew. I'd just like to say that these are very difficult questions you've set me today.
I'm glad. This is what we want, difficult questions. So you were 17 years from 2000 to 2017 at the Bank of England. Those are some pretty eventful years. You know, financial crisis, austerity.
Yeah. I mean, well, it started off very quietly, actually. I mean, the first few years were what we called the Great Moderation.
Right.
The financial crisis came along in 2007 and changed everything, really.
So, I mean, setting aside politics, was Britain's economy on an even keel prior to COVID? Were the fundamentals fairly sound?
Yeah, I think they were. I mean, we had full employment pretty much. Unemployment was about 4%. There was a lot of uncertainty associated with Brexit, you know, which we've been talking about for a long time. But the new government had come in and were planning to address, you know, some sort of controversial whether they succeeded or not, but planning to address regional differences in the economy. And so, you know, I think it was it was quite a good position to be in.
Mm. So what's the best analogy for a kind of thing out of left field like this, a sudden instantaneous global collapse? Is it, you know, we often hear people talk about the end of the Second World War, the 1920s depression, or is there some other case which best reflects what's happening to us now?
Well, it's very difficult to think of anything which has been similar to this. I mean, you mentioned at the start the 1707 frost, which caused the economy to freeze up. And this is,
yes.
I suppose, you know, the economy is freezing up pretty much at the moment. But it's, you know, it's very different to anything we've seen most recently. You know, I would sort of characterize it as a managed recession in the sense that we've sort of deliberately shut down or locked down quite large parts of the economy to stop the coronavirus spreading. So the economy is being used in a way as a sort of instrument to stop the virus. And it's not the sort of more normal type of recession where the problem is one of lack of demand, often, you know, where businesses can't sell what they're producing, and then because of that they lay people off, and because when they lay people off, those people can't spend, and you sort of get a vicious circle. You know, we're hoping it isn't going to be like that.
I mean, one thing that what I dimly remember from my O-level economics is that pent-up demand when released can be inflationary. But that seems to be such, you know, the scale of those things seems to be so huge that the idea that there's some kind of dam of demand that would break one day and put us into inflation again seems unlikely. Am I wrong to think that?
I think you're right. I think it is unlikely. You know, it's not impossible. Mm. And because, you know, there is a lot of stimulus has been thrown at the problem. So, you know, we see the Bank of England, for example, has pushed interest rates down to the floor, 0.1%, and they're financing a lot of the deficit at the moment. And it's possible, you know, if the lockdown is lifted and the economy gets back, recovers quite quickly, then that demand could be unleashed and be inflationary in the future. But, you know, at the moment, that seems relatively unlikely and not something to be too concerned about, because if it started to happen, you could, you know, you've got the tools to do something about it when it happens.
Yeah, it would be a great problem to have, I should imagine.
Yeah, I think that's probably the right way of looking at it.
So what is the kind of the scale of the reconstructive challenge here? I mean, I've been reading these terrifying figures about the 7% contraction in the economy, massive growth of unemployment. But what rate would the economy need to grow to get us back to kind of 2019 levels? And has it ever happened before?
Well, I mean, obviously there's a lot of uncertainty, say that first of all. But, you know, we've constructed a forecast where we do get back to 2019 levels at the end of next year. And the Bank of England has also produced a scenario like that. Now, there's no guarantee that either of these scenarios will come true, but they are certainly possible. So, in our forecast or in our sort of scenario that we've constructed, GDP falls by 15% in the current quarter. But then the economy starts to recover once the lockdown is eased, and that means that the GDP will be lower by about 7% in the year as a whole. And then next year, because as the economy continues to recover, we'll have growth of 7%. So, the way to think about it really is, it's a bit like imagine that you had a level of activity of which was 100, and it fell down to 90, so that would mean a reduction of 10%. And then it goes back to 100. And then obviously you're going from 90 to 100, which is slightly more than 10%. That's the sort of scenario that you can imagine happening. Although, as I say, there's a lot of risk around it.
Can you translate what that sort of growth would look like, on the high street, or in terms of employment, or in terms, in the real world? If you're looking at, because what we often hear abstract figures of percentage growth and percentage contraction, but they obviously mean factories closing or opening. They mean shops closing and opening. In your projections, what sectors are more likely to enable us to recover? What is the business world likely to look like if this happens?
Well, I think what's in this scenario, I think what's happening really is that it is really just a closing and an opening. So, we've seen lots of sectors of the economy at the moment which are just not open, pubs and restaurants and all that. So, their activity goes from, whatever it is to zero, and then it recovers again. So you'll be seeing, on this particular scenario, you'd be seeing that, it's more like, Christmas, when everything shuts down for a while and then reopens. It's that sort of position of course, an extended period.
Yeah, but of course in Christmas we reopen to the January sales and everything's cheap and there's kind of less of business all of its money in the course before Christmas, isn't it? So, obviously I'm sort of overstretching your analogy there to a ridiculous extent, but the idea that a lot of people seem to be skeptical about the idea that once reopened, the economy will go back to normal, because we've already seen increases in unemployment and a collapse in confidence. In your projections, are you imagining that, have you modelled behaviour that people will be willing to get back, spend, go out, eat, drink, buy stuff, travel?
I suppose the answer is that we're assuming that behaviour hasn't changed, and that is, it's a reasonable thing to challenge, because it's possible that because of the crisis that people have been through, that they will do things differently when the lockdown is eased. So we're assuming that the people will go back to restaurants and pubs and travel on the trains just exactly as they did before. But people may be suspicious of public transport, for example. So that you would see a change in the type of activity going on if there is behavioural change. So maybe there'd be more cycling, which would sound a very positive thing. But on the other hand, it may be more people sticking to their own cars, which would probably be a negative thing.
Yeah. So I want to get into this. You mentioned pubs and clubs and restaurants and cafes are the thing that's, because they're visible, because they're on our streets and we see them shuttered and we see many of them with for sale signs outside, to let signs outside. But beyond those sectors, such as hospitality, which is a huge employer and massively important, often for low paid and vulnerable people, are there other areas of the economy that are especially vulnerable to what we're going through now and that might not actually come back?
Well, I think there is a lot of vulnerability. I told you about a scenario, but that scenario was quite an optimistic one in the sense that everything comes back as it did before, where I think the risks are that that doesn't happen, because there's a lot of, even very successful businesses are in a precarious state. And, it may be that some businesses shut down and then you're, if you're in a supply chain where your best customer shuts down, then it's going to be very difficult for you to continue. We've seen that companies like Virgin and British Airways are obviously very concerned about things. There's other sectors, you know, where you know, again, there could be unexpected shuts down. And then because a lot of the economy is made up of this sort of network, that can spread in a sort of unexpected way. You know, it is just that, you know, this, we're not in an economy where people, you know, produce something or produce a service which they sell straight to, you know, consumers. There's a lot of sort of people who are supplying other businesses. Mm. You know, they're not, you know, like business consultants, for example. You know, nobody wants to buy a business, you know, no ordinary consumer wants to buy a business consultancy. That's something that gets supplied to other businesses. So if those other businesses fail for whatever reason, then that makes consultancy more precarious. So, you know, because of the sort of network that the economy consists of, you know, it's often not clear where the problem would lie. And I think it's also true within businesses, you know, that, you know, a lot of big firms, you know, they may be selling one product, you know, say British Airways, you know, we all travel on those airplanes and stuff, but there's a huge sort of back office of people who sort of depend on that, on the airplanes, you know, being in the air.
Yeah.
You know, to give you another example of this, you know, football clubs. I mean, I just looked the other day at the number of employees at Chelsea Football Club. There's about 2,000 of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're obviously all dependent on the players doing their job. And so, you know, there's this sort of, I think the picture I want to present really is of a network where it's quite precarious, really, because, you know, there could be parts of that go down and take the rest with them.
I see what you mean. Chelsea, of course, have got a fabulously wealthy oligarch behind them, so let's not weep too much for that. Let's talk about the lower league teams.
Tell me what you need.
I mean, you know, you're right in that, you know, we do understand that the economy is a network, and we've all heard the, you know, the analogies of, you know, when you're like me, old enough to remember the miners' strike, when a pit closes down, what that means for all of the supporting sectors around it. You know, absolutely, you know, it will devastate an area because it simply slows economic activity in an area down to a crawl. Conversely, what sectors do you think are likely to recover fast? Which areas of economic activity, some of them may be manufacturing, which we, you know, tends not to be fashionable. We tend to think about knowledge and service. But, you know, which areas are most likely to come back? And are they likely to leave us with a different economic landscape after we've been through this experience?
Well, again, I mean, I think it does really depend on how quickly we go back to a sort of normal situation. You know, a lot of businesses are opening now. And if, you know, if we're able to sort of reopen the economy without the virus spreading, then I imagine we would go back to a fairly similar situation that we're in before. But on the other hand, you know, if the virus is still around and social distancing lasts for, you know, a year or two, then, you know, I think then you will see, you know, capitalism doing its job and people being inventive and producing things which wouldn't have made sense before. You know, different types of takeaway services, you can imagine, and you know all that sort of thing. Which again, you know, I'm not really able to anticipate, but you know, I just imagine that people would be imaginative in trying to supply what people want in a different environment.
So if the key determinant of the sort of business that's likely to recover is going to be social distancing, if businesses that require people to be on top of one another a lot, both customers and suppliers, are going to be more vulnerable, naturally it leads you to the idea that we've all seen delivery services have boomed, video conferencing has boomed, we all lived, you know, lots of us are living our lives on Zoom now. But many of those delivery services and many of those services where you don't have to be with or deal with people tend to be low wage services. They tend to be delivery. They tend to be drivers, not low skilled, but certainly low paid. You know, we got used to a full high employment with the question mark of, well, exactly how much are people being paid here? Are the contracts worth having? Is this likely to, do you think, push us, you know, further down that road of differentiation between low-paid workers at a basic service level and you know, highly paid workers at in the knowledge level?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, pay. It would be very interesting to see how the trends in pay pan out, because, you know, obviously, if there is more demand for this sort of delivery type workers that you were mentioning. As you say, not low skilled, but relatively low paid. But at the same time, there is still demand for high skilled people. And you can imagine that the pay of the lower paid at the moment would go up because there's more demand for that sort of person. I mean, but the sort of vulnerability of that is that, you know, if there is a problem in the high skilled part of the economy, then a lot of those people would then be looking for jobs, as well at the same time. So that would possibly drive all pay down a bit.
Yeah. We haven't seen mass unemployment in the UK since the early 1980s, and I'm just about old enough to remember what it was like. Our welfare system since then has been based on the concept of job seekers, the assumption that there are jobs out there and people need to be offered the route to them and in some cases encouraged to go there. And in other cases, you know, more of a stick than a carrot is offered. Are we in any shape to cope with mass unemployment now that that model just doesn't work? That the idea that there are loads of jobs out there waiting to be filled no longer seems to be the case?
Well, I think I'd say two things, really. One is that, in the 80s, I think people started to learn about how to get people back to work. And it took a long time to learn those lessons. But, you know, I think by about the middle of the 1990s, they had started to be learned in terms of, making sure people stay attached to the labour market by, you know, going to the job centre regularly and looking, you know, making benefits depend partly on people searching for jobs, but also providing training to people. And so I think that's one side of it, you know, how you can make people's job search more efficient. But I think the other side of it is if there just aren't jobs around, then I think it would be up to the state to start, spending more. So to have a sort of what we would call a fiscal expansion, so that would create the jobs that the private sector isn't creating. So I think, you know, the agenda of the government when it came in was, the government was going to invest more. They were going to spend more on levelling up the economy. So I could imagine that that sort of policy could be accelerated. So rather than trying to do it over a long period, you know, you could try and do it in a short period if there's lots of resources available.
Do you think we could end up in a scenario much like the American Works Project Authority or agency, was it, when essentially the government during the New Deal employed people to carry out grand expensive projects, largely to keep them employed, where it was a kind of a direct intervention into the labour market? We need to give people jobs, and what those jobs are almost secondary.
Yeah, but I mean, as I said, I think there are plenty of things that need doing anyway. So, they should have already been thinking about what levelling up meant and, you know, what extra infrastructure would be needed in the regions and so on. So I think there is certainly plenty of things that can be done. And so I think it would just be a question of sort of accelerating some of that. Yeah, I mean, one of the issues we've seen, through the crisis really is a lack of capacity in the hospitals and probably and also in care homes. You know, so there's definitely a need for more capacity there. There's long-standing issues about roads, which need improving. You know, there's rail, there's HS2, which is one of the sort of projects that they're going forward. Yeah, so I'm sure there's lots of things that could be done without having to sort of get people to dig holes and put money into.
Yes, well, I suppose all these things depend on they're kind of. They're quite classical approaches to what infrastructure is, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean hopefully it wouldn't be necessary to do that. You know, yeah. Hopefully, things will come back relatively quickly. You know, that is a backup, really.
But we may be looking at quite a different pattern of working and much more working from home. Conversations we were reading over the past couple of days about, you know, more cycling, working closer to home, spending less time traveling, you know, get out of the car, become less dependent on the car economy. It just makes me wonder what are the infrastructure projects of of the future that don't entail, you know, widening the M1, for instance.
So I mean, cycle lanes is a good opportunity. I mean, the government has promised, I forget how much money it was, but during the crisis, to invest more in that. And I think that would be brilliant if they could do more of that sort of thing.
Yeah. So the government has added some £75 billion to the deficit with these support measures for the economy in the past few weeks. Prior to this, we were told that the deficit must be eliminated at all costs, that the deficit was a major goal of government policy. Is thinking like that now in the past? I mean, do we just like forget about the deficit or worry about it later?
Well, I think, there is a sense in which you can worry about it later. I don't think there's any urgency to address it. You know, we have interest rates pretty much zero. And I saw in the paper today that the two-year interest rate was now negative. So, you know, it's not like you've got a big interest rate to worry about. So you can let things roll over for quite a bit longer. But I think, you know, the deficit is an issue. There was a leaked Treasury report in the Daily Telegraph the other day, which got quite a lot of attention, suggesting that the Treasury is now expecting a deficit of over $300 billion this year, which is, you know, very large indeed, about 15% of national income. And so that sort of amount of borrowing would take the national debt from about 80% of GDP closer to 100% of GDP. And that's the sort of level at which people start to get concerned. But as I say, I don't think there's any real urgency to address it. You know, I think the worst thing would be to try and bring in new taxes or, you know, to cut spending while the economy is still on its knees. And I think it'd be much better to get the economy up and running first and get things repaired, and then you can start worrying about the deficit.
It's you know, been massively politically controversial over the past sort of 10 to 15 years, particularly during the period of austerity, where many commentators considered that the government did precisely the wrong thing in pursuing the deficit and cutting public services at a time when perhaps the economic taps needed to be turned on to get us out of the consequences of the 2008 financial crisis. Well, this stuff, I mean, to people like me, and I'm sure many of our listeners, this stuff is massively confusing because you're not entirely sure how a deficit actually is financed, and particularly when the entire world is suffering simultaneous economic downturn. You know, do you just finance it the same way you always did, by issuing government bonds, or, you know, what if nobody's buying?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is quite a lot of confusion about this, and I think, you know, generally, if we'd suffered this problem and nobody else had, then it would have been possible to borrow from abroad to help. So we could continue to go to a pub, but the pub would be in another country rather than in this country, and you know, you'd be spending money overseas. But obviously, that's not around this time. So I think, I mean, in our analysis, and I think this is probably true, the government is really at the moment is borrowing from people who are unable to spend in this country to pay income to people who are unable to work. So I mean, that's how the borrowing is being financed. You know, the extra government borrowing is being financed by essentially people who are unable to spend, lending that, not necessarily directly to the government, but indirectly by putting deposits in the banks, which are then sort of feed their way into the government borrowing.
Right. What does a burden of debt do to the future of an economy in a situation like ours, where we really need demand to come back?
Yeah, well, I think you know that there are two things here. One is the sort of short term and the longer term. So I think in the short term, you've got to get demand back, and so, you know, if that means that the level of debt has to rise, then so be it. But, you know, once the economy is at full employment and demand and you have a balanced economy, then you can start thinking about how to address the debt. And I think we will need higher taxes than we would otherwise have done to pay for it. So, I don't think there would necessarily be a sort of coronavirus tax, but there could be, you know, where you sort of say this is going particularly to pay off the debt that we ran up in the crisis. I think generally, you know, you would probably have to have some higher taxes. And I think there's a sort of issue here that in any case, we were probably looking at higher taxes before the crisis because of an aging population, and that needs to, you know, older people need to be looked after, and, you know, obviously there are a lot of older people around at the moment, but but you know, there's a sort of pipeline of aging going on, which is going to take more taxation of society generally. So I think, you know, we need to brace ourselves for paying higher taxes, I think.
Right. I quite like the idea of corona tax, actually, because it depoliticizes it. It's like, it's neither right nor left, it's just we need to pay a tax.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, generally, economists don't like these sorts of taxes where you're sort of labelling it and saying this is for that thing, and you know, because you should really be, you know, spending on what's most important, and then taxing in the most efficient way of doing it. So you generally don't do that. But I think in this circumstance, I think it might make people understand a bit better what, you know, why they're having to pay higher taxes if it was labelled in that way. Yeah, there is that communication, I think, is quite important.
Well, it's like when you get a receipt in a pub in America, isn't it? You can see what the tax is.
Yeah, exactly.
We should do that here, see how much the VAT is. Idea for the Taxpayers Alliance there from the UK. So a lot of economists and policymakers have talked about this crisis as a kind of a potential reset moment for governments to do things differently, that you know, we have to use the fact that we've got a pause and an opportunity to think again to rebuild the world economy in a different way. Do you think that there is a kind of bipartisan impulse to move in that direction? Or are we looking at, I mean, obviously there are certain people who just want to reopen the economy as fast as possible, get back to normal and try and pretend it all didn't happen. But do you feel that there is an impulse out there to go for a bit of a reset?
Well, I'm not sure. I think I might be a bit more pessimistic than you about that, in the sense that you know, there are a lot of issues around which haven't really been properly addressed. You know, things like climate change, you know, in this country, levelling up of the regions, and then I think intergenerational fairness is another one where you know, where it has seemed recently a lot of cost of running society has fallen on the young rather than the old. So there are these big issues, but I can just imagine, you know, in the middle of the crisis, people are saying, "Oh, we mustn't waste a crisis. You know, we must deal with it. We must, you know, have a brave new world afterwards." But then, when the crisis is over, I can just imagine people forgetting all that and going back to normal.
Which is exactly what we did in 2008, and it led to enormous lasting dissatisfaction. Yeah. I mean, I know what you mean, but I mean, we all know the fable of 1945. The world had been through an ordeal and didn't want to just go back to the way that it was.
Yeah, but I mean, hopefully, I mean, this is obviously, this is a very serious crisis, but not on the same scale as the Second World War. So, you know, if it can be sort of defeated quite quickly, then I think, things would more likely be forgotten.
Yeah. I mean, just in closing then, you talked about the high possibility of higher taxes, the kind of industries that may or may not come back. What do you think it's going to mean for sort of life on the ground for our listeners? What sort of, how will life feel differently over the next few years if we can't get right back to that business as usual, reopen in September, pretend it all didn't happen? And what's it going to mean for the housing market, travel, job opportunities and stuff like that?
I'm hoping that, you know, some of the things you've mentioned before about, you know, a change in attitude and so on. I would be hopeful that would happen, but not convinced that it would. You know, if people have got less money in their pocket, then I think you probably see less frivolous things purchased. And you know, there will be a need, I think, for there to be better public services. I think that's one of the sort of lessons of the crisis, that, you know, there was sort of a lack of investment in the NHS over a number of years. And, yeah, we need to have more spare capacity in the world, I think, so that we, you know, if anything bad does happen, that we can respond to it. But in terms of the base, you know, housing market, you know, people will need to live somewhere. You know, with interest rates as low as they are, you know, I think, if they remain low, then I can see house prices not falling very much. Travel, you know, if we don't have to social distance, and I think people will be back in the planes before long as well. So probably not too much change if we go back to a world without social distancing.
And if we can't do that, we can always transition to a sourdough-based economy.
Yes.
Because it's where everybody's putting their time and effort. I don't know. I mean, I kind of have these sort of dim memories of you know, the long stagnation in Japan where they had, low interest. Didn't they have low interest rates and very low activity and, low.
I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, that often, you know, these big recessions, they have very long-term drawn-out consequences. So really, our hope is that this will be quite a short, sharp one, and then we'll get back to some sort of normality. But, you know, if that doesn't happen, there are certainly risks that things will be different and a lot worse.
Well, Britain will always be able to depend on its booming podcast industry, so we're going to do our bit and see what we can do. Gary, thank you very much for joining us on the Bunker Daily. It's been fascinating. Lots to chew on. I have a strong suspicion we'll be returning to these subjects over and over and over again. Well, yeah. Thank you for joining us. Listeners, there's a full-length show every Wednesday and a Bunker Daily on Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays and Fridays. If you could leave a nice review on Apple Podcasts, that will be absolutely delightful. Better than the Today programme, says user Privacy78. Who I guarantee does not work for us. And if you want to get the show early and without ads, search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out how to sign up. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Dr. Gary Young, and we'll see you again soon.
The Bunker Daily was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison. The assistant producer was Jacob Archbold, and audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.